All right, so Wednesday, April 11th, we're doing the Wednesday night group. So we're going to be discussing an idea pertaining to Yetzias Mitzrayim. And two sources. One, the first would be chapter Yud Aleph, but the first few psukim. In the course of conveying to Moshe, this is by the Makas Bechoros, you know, the last of the Makos. So, this would be Yud Aleph Pasuk Beis. After Hashem tells him that he's going to bring one further Makkah, and afterwards he's going to utterly drive you out of the country. And then it says, Daber no biyozne ha'am. Please speak to the people. V'yishalu, that's a very V'yishalu itself is a very interesting term. Does that mean they should request, or does that mean they should borrow? The Torah is basically vague on this. And that's a separate issue. Remind me, and we could take it up a different time. That's not the topic for tonight, but there's a big issue that the commentators talk about. And that is that, did they request that the Egyptians give them as gifts, or did they request that they should be allowed to borrow it? Of course, a problem arises. If you say it's a gift, so then there's no issue. But if you say that it was borrowing, so then they have an obligation to give it back, and obviously they never give it back. So then they're, you can call it theft or deception or whatever the case may be. That's something that has to be addressed. And it is that issue is addressed. And there's basically three major viewpoints on that. But as I say, make a note of it and we can come back to that. That's not the topic for tonight. But the point is they're being instructed to ask each one from his friend, and a woman from her friend or acquaintance, whatever. Vessels of silver, vessels of gold. Now, if you stop at this point in time, you have to ask a question. I mean, the idea at first glance seems a little preposterous. Because it's one thing to say that the underlying reason is because Hashem promised to Avram that when the Jews leave, they would leave with rechush gadol, with great wealth. I mean, so now is the time when Hashem is fulfilling that, is dealing with that phenomenon. But wouldn't you say that the method is kind of strange? And that is that you'd expect that Egypt, if the point is that Egypt owes the Jews because they enslaved them, and this is a form of restitution, compensation, whatever you want to say, then you would expect it would, well, I don't know if it could come about in the negotiations between Moshe and Paro. I'm not sure, because Paro, it possibly could have been, up until this point, Moshe couldn't make that demand, because Moshe was not insinuating or making the demand that he should let the Jews leave the country altogether. Ostensibly, it was just, which again is a separate issue. That's another issue. Please make a note of that.
Is that a ruse?
Yeah, that did the Jews again employ deception, creating the impression that they just wanted to travel
for
3 days' journey and worship their God and then return. And yet, in point of fact, they never did that. Now, you can say that, well, they had no right to enslave them, and if you're illegitimately enslaved, you have a right to lie. That's fine. But Hashem didn't have to do it that way. Hashem had all the power. Hashem could have done it in a way where he demanded that Paro free them. Okay, that's again another separate topic. Put that on the list, please. I don't want to forget. That we can return to. But this is a strange thing. Because why would an Egyptian be willing to give his finest? His finest clothing? Well, that's another point that comes up. I don't know if I'll be able to get around to that tonight. But I had never noticed this problem. Because here it says,
it doesn't mention the clothes.
It does not mention the clothing. Here it says that each one should ask for jewelry, basically. Vessels of gold, vessels of silver. Okay, now, what happened, actually. The Torah picks up the story in chapter Yud Beis, in the midst of discussing what takes place when they on that night and when they finally leave. So if you take a look at Yud Beis, Lamed Hey, it says, Uvnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe, that the Bnei Yisrael did what Moshe had told them. Vayishalu mimitzrayim, again, same word, and they requested or borrowed from Egypt, chlei chesev uchlei zav usmolos. Now smolos comes into the picture. Of course, the question arises, how did smolos? They weren't instructed to ask for smolos. So how would they, how does it turn out that they gave them smolos as well? Okay? That's a separate
you get sure on the, and then issue. Rashi there. The smolos were the more Rashi with Pshat.
Are we to assume that they asked for smolos as well? And maybe it's just not being mentioned? Like the Ramban says that sometimes the Torah is, you know, rich in detail in one place and poor in other places. And is it possible that really the instruction to Moshe included smolos, but the Torah didn't mention it, and now it mentions it over here? That to me is not convincing, because where the Ramban brings that down, there's a reason for that. Because why would the Torah omit the mention of smolos? Or else, you could say that they, it wasn't like a mitzvah that you have to ask bedafka just for this and nothing else. Is that what we're saying? That the Jews were only permitted?
Or
that the Torah is mentioning vessels of gold, vessels of silver, but if you want to ask for other things, that's up to you. You have to ask for vessels of gold, vessels of silver. It's interesting. that the emphasis is on. Because although Rashi indicates that the clothing was of greater value to them than even the vessels of gold and the jewelry,
Isn't that strange?
I'll explain that in a second. Penny says that
I'll tell you a pshat.
Gave a pshat.
Back in Plainview.
I don't remember giving a pshat. So I just gave a pshat the other day. Maybe it's the same one. And I just forgot that I said it in the past. But I will explain why, if that's the case, so then that's more precious to them. So why didn't God knows that, of course. So why didn't God tell them to ask for smolos? If that's the main thing. That I could answer on the spot. Because, you see, you have to understand the reason behind the command, the purpose or the objective, was that they should leave Berchush Gadol with great wealth. So smolos is not wealth. No matter, it might be more important to you for whatever reason, but it's not wealth. A person has tons of clothing. But essentially, It's a functional thing. You could use it, style. It's a luxurious thing, but it's not something that carries that kind of worth on the market. It goes, you know, it's in style, this and that, and it's not. If a person only had a tremendous amount of clothing but didn't have any money in the bank, nobody would say he's wealthy.
It's not a storehouse of value.
Yeah, but the gold and silver, that's rechush.
Yeah.
That's a wealthy nation. You can do things with that. You can build things. You can buy things. You can build a big army, whatever the case may be. You can't do that with smolos. So that's why the command of Hashem, the purpose was that the Jewish nation should be a substantial nation, should not be poor. They should be rich. So therefore, it's referring to items of wealth. Okay. Now, in terms of why for the individual Jew, it seems counterintuitive. You would imagine that the gold and silver would be of greater value than the clothing. Okay, so Penny says that I gave pshat on that. Go ahead, Penny.
So, psychologically, even though that gold and silver is much more valuable, but psychologically for the Jews who were suffering from a sense of a slave mentality, to wear the clothing, the dignified clothing of their oppressors, allow them to reconstitute their sense of godliness, their greatness, by being able to sense of identity and chashivas, because they're wearing not clothing of a slave, but clothing of dignified aristocrats, and they made them feel fantastic.
Yeah, I would say I gave a little bit of a different angle, same along the same lines, because the question came up the other day, and I was thinking, you see, it depends upon the circumstances of a person, and there's a difference between jewelry and clothing. Because jewelry is essentially doesn't have intrinsic value. It's all because of man's fantasy. Man ascribes value to it. But like the, you know, the most impressive diamonds and so forth. So it has no real value. It's an amazing thing why people spend such fortunes on it. It's purely in the imagination. Or a gold bracelet. So what? What is the value? It has no practical value. But in man's imagination, it's an object that he projects great significance onto. But clothing is real value. Now, in certain circumstances, people will lust after jewelry. I understand that. Because that's part of the person's fantasy. But when a person is in a situation where he doesn't have decent clothing, so that's a real need, and he's cognizant of that. Like, I remember a story from this guy way back when. He had been a soldier. I believe he was a soldier with the U.S. Army, and he was in Europe at the time when the war ended and the Jews were liberated. So he did whatever he could to help the survivors. And he met this guy, and he saw the guy, and he said, what can I get you? What can I do for you? So the guy said, you know, the Jews, they wore like tattered, you can't even call it garments, the stuff they wore. And the shoes, it wasn't even shoes, it was like a wooden clog. He said he needed a pair of shoes. So this guy was able to go, you know, and he found a beautiful pair of leather boots. And he brought it to the guy. And he says, the guy was like, Phil, he was like, he couldn't stop gushing. How beautiful. In other words, if you'd have told him, I'll get you a diamond watch right now, it's of no meaning to him.
Right.
He's in the parasha of reality. In the parasha of reality, I need clothing. Like if you're going to, for whatever reason, you have to be in Alaska for a couple of months and then mainly outdoors in the cold season, you're not interested in necklaces. And you want that warm clothing. So the Jews are in this situation. And they're going to go into the wilderness for an extended period of time. That was more precious to them. So aside from the fact that restoring their sense of dignity and all of that, because the jewelry would also restore. But when a person is in a situation where he needs the basics, then his mind is completely focused on the basics. And luxuries are really of no significance to him in that situation. The desire for luxuries comes into play after a person has his basics. And he no longer appreciates the fact that he has his basics. And now, that doesn't make him happy. He needs something more. Then the fantasy of man is aroused. It would be like some like great art. They have this, whatever you call it, quote-unquote great art. I don't understand how it can garner so much money. Like millions and millions of dollars. So it's an object, it's like jewelry. But if a person is in a need, he has real needs, you say, I'll get you this portrait, this painting. That,
Jackson
who cares?
Pollock, you know,
yeah, who cares? I mean, it's like, because then reality, in terms of reality, he has no need for it. He has no use for it. But clothing, he has a use for and a need for. So that's what I think it means, that to them, given their situation and what they were facing, the clothing was very precious. Okay, I would say that, like I said before, God's command was not based upon the situation of need. It was based upon the idea of establishing a nation and that the Jews would have wealth. So in terms of their particular needs, God gave them the opening because he told them to go and confront the Egyptians. Now, if you want, as we're learning, it wasn't that you're restricted just to these two things. If you see other things, or if the Egyptians of their own accord, they offer you clothes. Because you see, there was a tremendous response to this. The Egyptians were extremely favorable. Rashi says that they gave them more than they asked for. You say, you're pointing at that, take another, no, take more. So that I think Hashem could have left to them. That's not part of my command. My command was to keep the promise I made to Avraham, that they'd go b'rechush gadol. That's wealth. So these are not objects of wealth. But if you want, and you feel that there's nothing wrong with asking them, so that's what the pasuk would be pointing out. I hadn't focused in on this before. The discrepancy that they were told to ask just for gold and silver, and the response was that they gave them also they gave them smolo. So how do we work that out? Okay.
Sure.
Okay. So all right, that with regard to that issue, that suffices for the time being. But I want to get back to the basic question, and that is, how do we explain such a phenomenon? Why would the Egyptians want to give as a gift, or even to buy to loan as a loan, whatever it was, whatever you want to say, their finest jewelry? And that's a very difficult thing in the first place, you know, even if people that don't despise you. But we're assuming that the Egyptians, they have such great love and respect for the Jews.
Let's read the next passage.
Yeah, I understand that. How are we to account for this? That attitude, that emotional attitude, that they'd be happy. It's not easy for... How can you tell the Jews to go and do a thing like this? I mean, the guy will laugh at him. What are we, crazy? Okay, so the pasuk itself seems to anticipate that. In both places. In Yud Aleph it says, Vayiten Hashem Eschein Oam B'Yein Mitzrayim, that God... inclined or placed, whatever word you want to say, the charm. Chain is like a certain charm, a certain admiration for the nation in the eyes of Egypt. Gamo ish Moshe gadol miyod b'eretz Mitzrayim. Also, the man Moshe was exceedingly great in the land of Egypt. B'enei avdei Paro, in the eyes of the servants of Paro, u'b'enei ha'am, and in the eyes of the nation. So this is a very, very significant pasuk over here. Because it seems to be, why is the pasuk telling us this? I think it's an answer to my question.
Right.
Because without, you would expect that the Egyptians looked down on the Jews. They looked down on the Jews from the very start, because the Jews were shepherds. They were roei tzon. And the Egyptians,
that
was a toeva to them. They couldn't even eat with them, and so on and so forth. But certainly, after they've become slaves, and they're reduced to such a low level, I mean, it's not the way Americans looked down on blacks when they were slaves. And then, even to this day, you're not permitted to express anything that's racist, but there's no question that on the emotional level, or behind closed doors, I'm sure that there's plenty of racism. Of course, in large part, you look down upon people that appear to be inferior. So I would assume that too, the fact that they're slaves would not cause people to look up to them, to admire them, and to want to share their wealth with them. Also, it has to be pointed out. So my question is like this. But that changed. That's why the pasuk is telling you that some kind of a change took place, and the attitude, there was a transformation of attitude. The attitude towards the Jews was now one of admiration. So my basic question is, how are we to understand that? Is that, now it's possible Hashem could do that. We're not questioning that. God controls people's minds, emotions, and so on and so forth. But how are we to understand this? Is this, then this would constitute another miracle? Should we view this as a miracle? That's it. Poof. One day they despise you, and the next day, for reasons unbeknownst to them, but God has done something, and all of a sudden they love you. I mean, I'm not saying that that's not possible. Well, but is that exactly what took place? Is that the way Hashem operates? Or it's certainly better if we can explain it in a rational way. That is, if we can give an accounting for it based upon the information that's provided to us by the Torah over here. That's what I'm going to seek to do tonight. So when it says that God did it, it doesn't mean that could mean actually God, caused the change in their emotions. Or no, God is the source, and God is ultimately responsible for the changes that occurred. But the change occurred in a natural way. That's going to be the topic for tonight. Let's proceed a little bit, because the pasuk.
Can I throw in one other possibility?
I want to speculate. I'm going to be speculating now. As to what I think makes sense that could explain what's taking place. Now, an indication to me that it's a natural phenomenon It comes from that pasuk because it says Gamu Ish Moshe Gadol Miod Be'eretz Yisrael Be'ini Avdei Par Be'ini Am. Now, why? First of all, that itself is problematical. Why should Moshe have such esteem?
Right.
In the first place, if anything, that's counterintuitive. You'd have thought they'd be angry at Moshe,
right?
Because he's bringing all this trouble, the suffering upon them.
Right.
But secondly, why is it being? Why do we need to know that over here? The fact that Moshe was great in the eyes of Egypt. All right, let's assume the Torah wants to tell us that. But what does it have to do with this? This is talking about the chain of the Am.
Right.
So, as Pini said before, I think the Rav made this point, that it's related. Because the attitude that people have towards the leaders carries over to the people themselves.
Hmm.
If people have great leaders, so then it causes others, like Martin Luther King by the blacks, so he's recognized as being special and unique, so then that increases your respect for blacks in general. Because how could such a person emerge from this people? They can't be that bad. You have greater respect for the people that he represents. So that would indicate, I think that's at work over here. In other words, that's not the only factor, because it says gam, in addition. That's not the only factor, but it's relevant over here because it is a factor. It's one of the factors that plays a role in the transformation of attitude of the Egyptians. Now, let's ask ourselves this issue. But why? How do you account for that? Why should they have such great respect for Moshe? To the contrary, he was their tormentor. He was bringing pain upon them. So that's also strange, isn't it? Anyway, So I would say that it has to do with the character of Moshe, and it enables us to understand why Hashem chose him to be for this mission. See, Moshe himself said, "Who am I to go to Paro?" He couldn't deal with that. I don't mean to say he couldn't deal. He had a problem understanding why he was fit to play this leadership role because he lacked the ability to speak forcefully or the charisma and so on and so forth. Yeah, but we see that to the contrary. I think, this is what I'm suggesting, the fact that Moshe was the most humble of individuals, and he had all this power at his disposal.
Mm.
He had all this power at his disposal, and he demonstrated nothing but compassion and humbleness. He tried to explain, and at first the Makos were, more annoying than devastating. And he dealt with them with tremendous compassion because he warned them in advance. And then when the Makkah came and Paro appealed to him, he removed it immediately. So it was clear. See, in that situation, if you could have had a different kind of a leader, like somebody like a Trump. And I'm not saying this is not political, not whether you like him or don't like him, but he's very forceful, and you see his rhetoric with North Korea and threatening them if they. Now, I'm not passing judgment on that because at this point in time it seems like it had an effect and they're going to go negotiate. You see, but his style would have evoked tremendous hatred because it turns out that he's doing this to get even with us. He wants to punish us. That style would not have been appropriate in that situation. To the contrary, Moshe did not. He spoke with softness. He spoke with kindness, with compassion, because he only wanted to do it for the benefit of Egypt. They had tremendous respect for a person like that. They never encountered. You see, there's people have within them an ability to recognize genuine greatness when they encounter it. And this is when they saw Moshe, and given the whole situation of what his people had gone through, and the fact that he had the power at his disposal, and he conducted himself in this manner of tremendous humbleness and compassion, he cared about the Mitzrim. They were in awe of this man. They had a tremendous awe of this. And by the way, you see, he was effective. That he was getting them out, because it says by the Barad, he warned them to bring in any kind of livestock or slaves. And then it says, Hayarei Estavar Hashem, those who feared. So apparently his message was getting through. But that's how I understand. They did not look at Moshe as an enemy, and he was not bringing down these plagues because he wanted to get even with them, or that he enjoyed their suffering at all. So therefore, they couldn't attribute. They had to stop and think about it. What's the reason for this? Mm-hmm. Now, but this is not. So that's one factor, but it's not the whole story. There's another factor over here, and I think it's connected to this. It's the Makos. See, what was the attitude of the Egyptians to the whole enslavement? What was their attitude? Did they think it was the right thing? Did they think it was, were they opposed to it, that it's wrong? What was their rationalization? They had to have a rationalization. See, it's very, very interesting that people tend to accept, you know, the culture that they are born into, the country that they're born into and its culture, and even things that may not be correct. Like you see, the Founding Fathers, it's a whole issue now, that these were men who believed in human rights and dignity of man, so on and so forth. But for many of them, slavery was not a problem, which is a blatant contradiction.
Right.
But they didn't challenge, they didn't question, because they were brought up in a society which accepted that as being the norm. That's the way things are. So many people, there are, occasionally you'll find someone who's able to challenge the established convictions of the society. So what was the attitude, how did the average Egyptian look at the phenomenon that we're enslaving these people? What would you say? I don't think it disturbed them. Nobody, there's no indication from any source that the average Egyptian was opposed to it. No, they accepted it. Now, the question is, how did they justify it? You have to justify it. So I would say that pretty much what the Torah tells us about Paro, Hava Nischak Malo, that Paro undertook this because he made the case that the Jews represented a danger. That's what he convinced his people, that they're not really truly Egyptians, and all right, as long as they were small and confined, it's one thing. But the fifth column, now that they're expanding, getting bigger, and so on and so forth, we really have to worry about them. We can't trust them because we have enemies, and an enemy will attack us, and they'll join the enemy. Now, however, he presented it to the people. That's basically, I would say, what they accepted. Okay? Maybe not as harshly like Hitler accused the Jews of being a fifth column, stabbed them in the back. I don't know exactly what that's essentially what Paro himself thought and his own people. But in selling it to the nation, I don't know how far he went, but clearly you'd have to assume that was the basic idea. We have no choice because we can't trust them. We have enemies and we're vulnerable. People are always coming to Egypt and so on and so forth, and we have wars, and now we have a fifth column. I would say that's better. So therefore, it's justified. And they were able to maintain that. And no one's going to bother. Then that's the second generation is born into the situation. That's the given. That's how it is. And they don't assume that their fathers are corrupt and they're living in a corrupt society. So that's prevailed. Now, something happened, obviously, as long as they had that attitude, that wasn't Chein Ha'am. Then they didn't, because that wouldn't make any sense. You can't have an attitude of admiration for this people, and at the same time, you're totally content with the fact that they're being enslaved, I mean, tortured. It doesn't make any sense. So something came along to change that attitude. Keep in mind, all this is part of my speculation. You'll have to review it afterwards. What was that? What came along? The Makos. The Makos. You see, as long as everything is in order, everything is fine, so you're complacent. You don't care. You're not going to think about this. But the Makos, when a person experiences pain, then he starts questioning, why is this happening to us? Why is this happening to us? Why are we suffering like this? So I would suggest that perhaps it went in two phases. And the first phase was, why? Oh, what's the answer? Because Paro, Moshe went to Paro and he made a request. It's a pretty modest request. All they want is a little bit of time to worship them, and then he won't give it to them. That's the, I would say, would be the first area. Brought about by the pain. As I said, people don't question a lot of things in their lives. But once they, you know, once they suffer, or they have certain symptoms, possible symptoms of a certain, then the mind gets work, they start doing research, they start thinking things they never were interested in before. I would say as the Makos got more painful, they asked another question. They finally got around to the big question. What's the big question? Why are we enslaving the Jews in the first place? Why are we enslaving the Jews in the first place? Okay? And they were motivated to think into that. Now, herein lies the weakness, so to speak, of anti-Semitism. All anti-Semitism is a form of insanity. Anyone who's an anti-Semite is basically defective, mentally defective. I'll tell you why. It's because it's all based on absolute sheker. Not just a little bit of lies, but throughout history, they've always castigated the Jews, but it's to an extreme. It's such an extreme that it has nothing to do with reality. Anybody that would look into the situation, oh, the Jews are disloyal. Bloodsuckers, what?
Blood libel. You know,
blood libel. They use making matzahs. Anybody that would, and the whole character of the Jews, what kind of people they are, they're not loyal. Like Haman said to Ahasuerus, all these things are absolutely false because the Jews are the most loyal. What if they've done nothing but enrich? If you want to look at, there's different groups that they have in the society that are dangerous, that have gangs, that drugs and so on, crime. It's not that the Jews are perfect, but relatively speaking, they're the most productive citizens you'd want to have. Anybody would want to have these people. They have the lowest crime rates. They're the most intellectual, and they contribute the most, and they help other people the most. Look at all the things they say about Israel. But Israel, the only ones that treat the Syrians that are killed by their own government is Israel. It's so far removed from reality that it's virtually, how could you maintain it? You'd have to be insane. Now, I have this, if you ever heard of Nani Darwish? You've heard of Nani Darwish. Yeah. She stayed over at my house. She was a Muslim. She gave it up. She was an Arab. Her father was the chief of intelligence for Nasser when he was the president of Egypt. And she went through an experience where she was raised with all the lies about the Jews, you know, hated the Jews are this, the Jews are that. But what happened was that her brother, I think he had a heart attack or a stroke, whatever the case may be, and he was in a desperate situation. So these very same Arabs that have nothing but, you know, what they say about the Jews, they said, if you want to save his life, he's got to go to Israel. Got to go to, I don't know, Hadassah, one of the hospitals. And they had no choice. Even though, on the one hand, you're saying that they kill Arab babies and this and that, they do all these horrible things, but we're going to put our lives in their hands. I mean, you see, it's like a form of insanity. Anyways, he went to Israel, they took him in, they saved his life. They even provided for Bikur Cholim, because he's an Egyptian. Who can he talk to? They found Egyptian Jews, you know, Jews that had come from Egypt, and they went to visit him just to be able to talk to him, you know, because they were Egyptian too, or they had been. So she came to visit him, and she could not believe it, that everything that they've told her is absolutely false. Everything. How could it be? Look at how the kindness, the compassion. Then she, you know, she went around the land and so on and so forth, and she saw with her own eyes that it's all falsehood. So she loved. That's the effect that it has. When you've been told nothing but lies about someone, degrading, and it turns out that it's not true and it's just the opposite, so then there's a tremendous reaction. She loves Israel. She had her daughters went to Israel, you know, spend the summers there and so on and so forth, and she wrote books. She's not the only one. There are others. There's many Arabs that go through this experience, but they're so stubborn and they're so you know, corrupted that they can't change their attitude. Her brother didn't change his attitude. So he did not change.
The one who was saved did not.
The one who was saved did not. No, wow. He couldn't negate. But there are many Arabs that realize that that's all false, not true. And they develop a tremendous love of the Jews. Now I want to suggest by the way, you'll see that this is a remez limos hamashiach. There's a teaching over here. I'll soon try. I want to suggest that that's basically what took place, due to the fact that the entire persecution was based on absolute lies. So when they were in a situation of pain, they were forced to challenge that. Why did we enslave them in the first place? Oh, because there are people that can't be trusted, and they're going to turn against us. And they what? So they started to study the history. And they discovered that, you know, what do you mean, Yosef, their ancestor, he saved the country. And we invited them down. And we gave them a place. And since that time, they've been nothing but loyal. I'll tell you what, who built Pitom and Ramses? Was that a disloyal thing to do? That was the Jews, in fact, actually did that because they wanted to show their loyalty. So you see what I'm saying? So they, under the pressure of the Makos, they had to investigate. And when they investigated, they came to the conclusion that Sheker Nachlu Avosam, that they have inherited Sheker. And that's what the Rambam says by Mosa Mashiach. The Rambam says, you know, the famous Rambam, which was censored for many years, where he says that in spite of the fact that Christianity and Islam are false and corrupt, and distort the entire Torah, nevertheless, Hashem will use them to His purposes. And that is because now the entire world is filled with the knowledge of Mashiach. Everybody knows about the phenomenon, and everybody accepts it, and everybody's waiting for the Mashiach. Except each one has a different version as to who he will be, and what he'll do, and so on and so forth. Since because of that, they're all looking forward to the Yemos HaMashiach, when the real Mashiach comes, and he carries out the full program, and he builds the Beis HaMikdash, so the whole world will recognize. And what they'll say is Sheker Nachlov. In other words, what we received from our forefathers and forefathers is all Sheker. Which is an amazing phenomenon. That's very rare. Because once a culture is steeped in certain ideas that they've been taught and indoctrinated by their parents, it's very hard to uproot that. So you see, this is what I'm suggesting. But the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim contains that idea of Sheker Nachlo. That the Egyptians, how do you see it? Because their whole attitude changed. When they recognized the truth, in other words, they recognized the lie, that they had been fed nothing but lies, and that the Jews were not what we've made them out to be, then they had a tremendous, that's the natural reaction. Then you have a tremendous awe for this people. This is a people that's been falsely, a person, you see that in any society, where a person has been falsely accused and over a long period of time and made to suffer. And then you discover that the entire thing is false. So you have, you know, obviously you feel very bad about that, but it expresses itself in a tremendous admiration. You have a tremendous admiration for this people, and you want to do things for them. You want to make it up to them. You need to express that positivity. So that's what I want to suggest. Along those lines, obviously, I mean, I'm just giving you a broad outline of what could have taken place. That it's not necessary to assume that it was just a miraculous thing. That God tampered with their emotions and put in a love the Jews suggestion. They were given that suggestion, love the Jews. No. But that it was genuine. And it's rooted in the idea that the hatred of the Jew is Sheker. It's based on Sheker. So that's a positive thing, because that means that in circumstances where people are forced to confront the lies, like that woman I mentioned, who was forced to confront the reality that everything I've been told about the Jews is false. And people don't like that either. People don't like when others try to fool them, when they try to fool me and lie to me about very important things. So then she gave up Islam. She converted to Christianity. But the natural thing is to turn against these people. They're a bunch of liars, because that's looked upon as a very disgusting thing.
So why do they chase after
to persecute? One thing, to persecute people unfairly, and on the basis of lies, a whole system of lies that you and people don't tamper with my mind. This is my mind. I mean, people get very offended by a thing like that. If anybody does that to you, I mean, if someone caused you to hate somebody by telling you all kinds of terrible things about the person, and then you discover it's all lies, it's all sheker. But you trusted him and you believed him, and because of this you experienced hatred for that person, and then finally something occurs to cause you to find out the truth. So you're going to be extremely angry at that person. What right do you have to tamper with my mind? And you're going to have a tremendous sense of respect, not just respect, but you're going to feel beholden to that person because you hated him for the wrong reasons. And you're going to feel you really have to make it up to him. So that's what I want to suggest. Now, Rabbi Rosenthal is asking that why did they chase after the Jews if that's the case? Well, first of all, that's a question not on my theory.
I know it's not.
Because that's in the story. On the one hand, we see Chaynam, and the other hand, they chased after them. So that seems to be. But I don't think it's a problem. Because who chased after them?
The army.
The army.
So they have
the army was under the control of Paro. So they didn't have a say. There's the attitude of the people, of the population at large. The population at large did not chase after the Jews to kill them.
Right.
That was Paro. And Paro, that's it. He, in spite of everything that happened, he couldn't change. He couldn't change his position, his opinion. So he got the army. And they were apparently, you know, that's like the Nazis. The Nazis and the Nazis, but the average German is a different story.
Right.
What his attitude was.
That's a good distinction.
The Nazis were the one. Now, again, there were Germans. The Germans did not go through this, by the way, through this process. Maybe we have to study it. To what extent did the discovery of the Holocaust after the fact? It's a complicated story because how the Germans dealt with the Holocaust. I mean, for a very long time, they didn't want to teach it. They didn't even want to acknowledge it. So it's a different kind of a story. Nevertheless, you will find instances, though. We don't have any time now. But you will find there has been a movement of Germans who've converted to Judaism and have teaching Torah in Yerushalayim or in Israel. There is a phenomenon like that. And I've given talks on it, but I can't go into that now. Although I do have, it was taped at the time. I'm not sure where you
could
get it.
That's literally 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, but I gave it at Plainview, if you remember, on a Rosh Hashanah. You should remember.
I do remember that. Sure.
And then I taped it. But,
The B'nai Haman are in B'nai Barak, that same, the
Gemara. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Based on the Gemara. Gemara says that.
Yeah.
Lists all these Rishayim whose children, whose grandchildren are teaching Torah.
Right. It's a phenomenon, a psychological
thing. There is a phenomenon, but I showed the actual case where it took place. But anyways, we're getting back over here. So clearly there's a difference between the Nazis who were engaged in the extermination of the Jews and so forth, and the average German. The average German, not every German, became a member of the Nazi Party. So it would have been conceivable that it didn't happen, but had events occurred in such a way that the average German would have come to the realization that all that propaganda is false. But still, if that were the case, that wouldn't change the Nazis. They're in a different category, a different degree of evil and an inability. I don't know how many Nazis. There were Germans that recognized, you know, that they were wrong. But as far as Nazis are concerned, that's a different story. And that's what I would say over here. The fact that Paro and his own army chose to, you know, maintain their stubbornness and to chase after the Jews, that does not contradict in any way, shape, or form the phenomenon of Chayn. So that's basically what I wanted to do. Yeah. The first, now we could see as we think about it, it becomes even clearer. The fact that they attributed greatness to Moshe. So it's not just a matter of saying that the respect carries over to his people. But there's something else over here. Because if it's true that the reason for the esteem was because they recognized his tremendous qualities, that he was sympathetic, that he was compassionate, that he only wanted to elevate them, so then that tells you something about this people.
Right.
That this is a people of compassion. It's not just him.
Right.
It's the same thing in the reverse. In the reverse thing when...
It can't be the fifth column.
Yeah, in the reverse. When Haman hated Mordechai, say, he extended all those characteristics, whatever it was, to the people.
Right.
Conversely, when you see that this is their leader, and this is what he stands for, so this carries over. So this is you can't say that this is
a disloyal,
hateful kind of people.
Right.
Okay? But then, as you explore, and you look at the facts, this is what they're accused of, and let's look at the record, then you discover the truth, then you say, sheker nachalu, that we've been fed a bunch of lies. And that's very, once you've done that, you're estranged, and now they're estranged from the culture, they're estranged from their leaders, they're estranged from Paro, he's a liar, and the good ones are really the Jews. See, it's just the opposite. It's because of Paro's jealousy or weakness, whatever it is. But these are good people. That's what I'm suggesting took place.